Good afternoon, everybody. Excuse me. It's Shmuel Plotzker coming at you live from Cincinnati's Gulf Manor Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. We are here on campus in our new classroom in the chapel building. It's very nice. It's a little bit warm. We're waiting for Joe the plumber to put in the AC unit. But when he does, oh, things are going to be great. At all events, sorry I couldn't meet with you last week. I was on the road traveling to New York City to get my daughter from Camp Sternberg, and she had a very nice summer. I hope all of you also had a very nice, productive, relaxing, and enjoyable summer. And here we are. We're halfway through the month of Elul, and we've got 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah. And it's time to start hunkering down, settling down, and getting down to cases and getting our work going. So without further ado, we're on page 318. We didn't meet last week, so we didn't go very far, obviously. We're still on page 318. If you have the book, great. If you don't, I'll do the heavy lifting. I'll do the reading. You do the enjoying. There's a lot here today. I'm telling you, there is so much food for thought over here today. I am so glad you're joining me. Those of you who are in Israel, welcome. It's about 8 o'clock, I think, in the Holy Land. Hopefully it's a good time for you. Here we go. You've got the book, 318, and it is in the middle of the page. Perek Lamed Zayin is what Rabbi Teichtal or the editors call this particular paragraph or two. And in the parentheses, in the margin rather, it says in bold, after all of our suffering, everyone must advocate Aliyah. And let's see what that's all about. The Medrash states, and it's going to be a Medrash, see Tana Devei Eliyahu, Zuta, chapter 4, Keter 4, also see Yalkut Shimoni, chapter 1, paragraph 391. This Medrash is cited in Kol Yaakov. The Medrash states as follows, quote, the day the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, it was decreed that the Torah scholars will learn, the day the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, it was decreed that the Torah scholars will learn amidst pain and poverty and confusion so that they will pray for the coming of Mashiach. First of all, what's shocking just on its own, and we're going to get back to this, is that they're not praying for Mashiach before then. You only can get people to pray for Mashiach if they're suffering pain, poverty, and confusion. And these are the Torah scholars? It really is quite a shocking kind of a paragraph. I mean, just kind of a statement. And I think I'm allowed to ask that question because it begs the question. So you heard it. Only amidst pain, poverty, and confusion will our Torah scholars begin to pray for the coming of Mashiach. What is going on over here? Well, here's the rest of this. Rabbi Teichtal writes that it seems to me that the explanation of this midrash is based on something I heard from my brother-in-law, the brilliant rabbi, son of saints, our master, Rabbi Menashe Kleinschlitz, the spiritual leader of Gros Vardein. Again, the midrash says, the day the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, it was decreed that the Torah scholars will learn amidst pain, poverty, and confusion, so that they will pray for the coming of Mashiach. And our question is, these are our leaders. Why does it take pain, poverty, and confusion to get them to pray for the coming of Mashiach? You think that they would pray for it on their own? That's my question. And now he quotes this. Rabbi Moshe Klein, the spiritual leader of Gros Vardin, and now he says, the brilliant Rabbi Meir Shapira Zal, Av Beis Din of Lublin. Is that the famous Rabbi Meir Shapira of Daf Yomi fame?
Yeah.
Wow, the Av Beis Din of Lublin. Listen to this. This is never advocated in the good of circles. I'm going to read to you something shocking. If you have the book in front of you, good. If not, this might be a chiddush for you. I'm quoting. Here it is. The brilliant Rabbi Meir Shapira, Zichrono Livracha, Av Beis Din of Lublin, traveled around Hungary to speak to the Gedolim and the leaders of the generation about settling and building the land. Open parens. For it is well known that they oppose this matter. Close parens. Despite all of his arguments and proofs, he was unable to convince them to give their approval. At the end of his trip, he spent a Shabbos with a certain Rebbe, one of the leaders of a generation in this country. Rabbi Shapira noticed that the Rebbe had a custom of eating two portions of fish during Shalosh Shudos, which is, of course, the third festive meal on Shabbos, one portion of fish before lighting Havdalah candles, and one portion of fish after lighting Havdalah candles. The one before the lighting was called the fish of darkness. I'm now on page 319. And the one eaten after the lighting of Havdalah candles was called the fish of light. And here's the quote from Rabbi Shapira, the Lubliner, to his Hasidic host. Rebbe, now I understand why you oppose Aliyah and the building of the land. As long as you eat fish of light, you don't need Eretz Yisrael. But due to our numerous sins, the majority of Klal Yisrael eat only fish of darkness, and you are unaware of Israel's pain. End quote. That is an incredible quote from an incredible man, a little quieter, who says this to his Hasidic host about the fish of darkness and the fish of light. Rabbi Brillard, welcome, and do you want me to clarify anything more than what you heard?
Very quick, the first thing, to clarify, who said that last quote was Rabbi Lublin?
Yes, Rabbi Shapira.
I think a slight technicality is lost in translation. After Havdalah candles lit, you make Havdalah asking sources. I know what it's referring to, I believe. The Tunkelish of the Sudis, and the Tunkelish of the Sudis is, there's a whole back and forth, and I forget which forum it is, from website, whether it's an Amaratus or not an Amaratus. First time I ever saw it was from Camp Aguda. It's customary in many Hasidic dynasties, your courts, not out, many, to have what they call Tunkelish there, right? Tunkelish and so Sudis. My own belief is that before the time of electricity, who was going to, you know, when the candles went out or it was starting to get dark, who was going to, how they going to get a light on, you know? So as the Sudis continued, it would get darker and darker and darker. And when Zman came, I'm not sure whether they were more ahead there to ask the guy, even though they hadn't done an hour, but it's still Zman. Or maybe they had one. At the Sham, one person designated a Dav Bichidis, or just to say, Baruch Hamabda, because it's a hole, and to light it. So, I mean, this is a Camp Aguda. The lights were not on when you came to the dining hall for Shalosh Shudos. While you were still, the eating part was still light enough, you know, natural light, to manage. But as the Divrei Torah and the frenzy, the dancers that I touched a goy, I think I told you that one, as part of the highlight of Shalosh Shudos. As all that continued, it would get darker and darker. It was virtually impossible to do anything. Then, at a certain point, which is way later than any Zman that I was familiar with, but at a certain point, even though we're still sitting in Shalosh Shudos, maybe it was 72 minutes, I feel like it might have been later, the lights went on, however. So there's a whole discussion as to whether that was originally simply by necessity, no other way to have, no technical way to have light. And then afterwards, like many things in Hasidus, in my opinion, some of our opinions, they rationalized it as, you know, something holy, something special, because it lends this air of mystique to it. But the Chorah, it contradicts the whole idea of the Shabbos, you're supposed to have light. And that even after the time when the electricity and Shabbos box came around, those groups preserved it. So others said, no, it's a holy thing, it's a mystical thing, and if you're going to argue that you're supposed to have light where you eat on Shabbos, that if you note the way it generally works, is as long as you're actually eating, it's still light. It's only after the eating with the Divrei Torah and the dancing, singing, whatever, that's when it starts. So this is interesting. So I believe what it was is he had this minhag, the Tunkelish of the Sudis. And when he ate that first piece, that was before somehow the lights went on, like whatever method. It was called the fish of darkness. Maybe they called that Havdalah lights. I don't honestly know. But I would have to see the Hebrew, you know.
course.
And then once the lights went on, he still ate that second piece of fish. That was a fish of life.
Uh-huh.
It rings true. That was, you know, because of that minhag.
I think you gave a good shot on this. I think that's exactly what's going on over here. And I think that it works beautifully. And that's what's going on. The fish of darkness and the fish of light. Thank you, Reb Rula, for shedding some light on that. I myself also was in Camp Agoda. And I do not remember that aspect of it. But having been in Israel for 2.5 years, I think that I remember maybe seeing a darkened in the Hasidic circle. It's possible that it became dark, obviously, because lights went out and whatever, and that's how they did it. But I don't really have too much of a very, very vivid recollection, either in America or in Israel, of a Tunkel of Shalashuddis. But is it fair to say that if you went to certain Hasidic circles in America today, you would definitely find that anyway?
Absolutely.
Did you find that in Hungarian circles and so on?
I've read that. I can't even remember which way I haven't gone, but I've read that.
So Satmar and Sugit and Pupa, this is not unusual.
I can't vouch for the particular ones. I suspect it's usual enough. Right, but I can't vouch that I haven't been there.
Fascinating, and it gives all the pshat that we need to make some sense out of this, and thank you for that. And then Rabbi Shapiro lays a bomb on him and tells him that you're eating the fish of light and you're on your own. You're a tzaddik, and that's good for you. But what about the rest of Klal Yisrael? Bavaseinu Harabim, we are stuck, and we're only eating fish of darkness. And you, now this is the real bomb. These last five words are bomb. You are unaware of Israel's pain. And that's going to come back to us right now in the next paragraph. So keep that thought in mind. Bank it. That Rabbi Shapiro is speaking to a tzaddik, and he says, listen, you know, you're Shakayach, you're a tzaddik, but you're unaware of Israel's pain. You're in a world of your own. You don't need Israel. You're eating fish of life. Now Rabbi Tachtel writes as follows. This is page 319, first full paragraph. Therefore, after all that we have been through here in Europe, where we have all eaten, quote, the fish of darkness, everyone must certainly approve of Aliyah and building the land. The fact that there are still individuals, and especially Rebbes, here in Hungary who oppose this is only because they have not yet, quote, tasted what most of Klal Yisrael has tasted. May God protect them from this. This explains the Midrash cited above, quote, it was decreed, we read it a moment ago, it was decreed that the Torah scholars will learn amidst pain, poverty, and confusion, so that they will pray for the coming of Mashiach. End the quote. And end the thought. And I'm telling you, I'm stunned by the whole thing, because I write my little note over here. Therefore, it seems that their entire outlook will change when they're hit in their own physical persons. And I find that amazing that their ashkafas will not be able to withstand reality. They have a certain both unshalong about, I don't know how to view Israel and Aliyah and the whole Zionism. But then when they start getting hit in the kishkas, according to Rabbi Teichtal, they're going to change all that. Their personal struggles will not be able to withstand their pain and suffering. And I find that amazing. I find the Midrash amazing. I find the whole thing amazing. And Rabbi Shapiro being as clear and straightforward and direct with that Hasidic Rebbe, I find that amazing. I find it amazing that Rabbi Shapiro, the facilitator and creator, if you will, of the Daf Yomi, came up with the idea, gave it to the Ger Rebbe at this. I mean, it's a whole Torah as to who, you know, created it and promoted it. But he'd be there as a man. His name is affiliated with the Aguda, and in all my life, I never heard of this. I never read anywhere in Aguda publications that their great Rabbi Meir Shapiro, the Abbezin of Lublin, went around speaking to the Gedolim in Hungary about settling and building the land. I'm amazed, and I need a little bit of help. Rabbi Rula, you always help.
Okay, this is new to me. I'm not really with this thing either. However, what I'm absolutely familiar is I know that for sure post-1948, and very probably by the time that this was being written, everybody was starting to change. Obviously, the ones that had the hardcore anti-Zionist hashkafa that we now called Satmar, Wunkach, that didn't change. But as far as those who were affiliated with the Aguda were also in a moderate way anti-Zionist, and specifically Gehr, many of them did change. In fact, I remember hearing from a shul rabbi who was actually a Belzer personally, but I read that about half of the Aguda did adopt this hashkafa, and it may have almost split them apart. I'm not sure if that had anything to do with the Degel HaTorah, but I'm not sure. I wanted to put it together, but I may be off. Yes, a good part of the Aguda, and I'm told that Gehr was the leader of that faction. Remember, the Gehr Rebbe of the time met with Rav Kook. It was a whole interesting thing, controversial. He held that although pre-1948, certainly pre-Holocaust, we would have been against the Medina. And now that the Medina is here, but the evidence shows it was Hashem's will. And we have to accept it, support it in a very moderate way, so on. Whereas others within the Aguda, they say, it's true, it's here. You can't deny reality. But that faction of Aguda says that the basic ideological thing that divides them from Satmar, Wunkach, is simply how to work with an undesirable situation. Do you work with it to try to, do the best you can, or do you shun it and protest it like those others do? But in itself, it's a bad thing. And the factions in Aguda, those two different eschatos, they felt that the difference between those two views is not significant enough in terms of the day-to-day, practical thing, as to have to split. They can still work together. But now and again, there are echoes of that you do hear. It's interesting, but my wife wrote a letter. She basically submitted a letter, identical or almost identical, to Rabbi Wein. And I think it was to Avi Shaffer who was here from the Aguda. Why haven't the Aguda agreed? Because you have to do Habimakir Tov, and Hashem did, for us to give us a Medina. So whether you observe it in Hey-Er or through Hallel or in some other time and in some other way, at least don't we owe Hashem HaKoras HaTov? Rabbi Wein was a suggestion because it came up between the two of us because he's known to travel in both circles. And she got a beautiful, small little answer. I've asked myself the same question. May Hashem provide us all with wisdom. And at a later time after that letter was sent and answered, Rabbi Wein was brought to Cincinnati. Remember, he spoke, I think, between Nussemarv at CVE. The basic content of his speech was, in a longer form, exactly my wife's point, that we have to have something. That was Rabbi Wein. Now, the letter she got from was Rabbi Shaffer. I have to confirm if it was him or someone else, my guru who came here also. His answer was that surely you know, or something like that, that within our circles, our good official circles, there is a difference of opinion as to whether the Medina is a positive thing or not. So obviously, we could not endorse anything along those lines without the faction, the negative, the naysayers taking offense. So which just confirms what I've known for the longest time. They try to keep quiet that there are two very different hashkafas within Agudas Yisrael. And I think it started to change already around that time. You know that Aguda, we may have mentioned this here before, in 48 did, after a lot of deliberation, agree they did sign the Declaration of Independence of Israel. And it's a fact. So they ever want to say, we as Israel are opposed to it, we're opposed to it, they're on their names on it.
And did they not serve in the very first Knesset?
I believe it's my Let us correct, they did and then left very early because, I don't know if they left, they never left the Knesset. I think they even served early on in the coalition government. And then there was some issue where they felt there was a no-confidence issue, they couldn't remain, you know, under those conditions. And occasionally they've gone back and forth. However, participation in Knesset would be something that both factions of the Agud would agree on. That's, I'm saying in practice it's very little difference because even the more negatives are saying now that we have to work with the UU situation. So that means
they never ever ultimately go to where Stotner goes of shunning participation. They do indeed participate. So it never gets that extreme.
Right.
When the pedal hits the metal, they never get that extreme.
Exactly. Think about how they involve themselves, how they, I should say, have taken position in terms of the army. Okay, women, of course, chas v'shalom, even in the Sherut Lumi, to be a nurse, to be a teacher, and so on, chas v'shalom. As far as men, absolutely for the army in theory, but now yeshiva bocher, my theological students in every country, normally they're exempt. Naturally, every guy who's not a mutager, if you know the German modern Hebrew, is mentally deficient, let's say, is a yeshiva bocher in our church. Every yeshiva bocher has to be exempt. And then think about the fact that even those who still would remain to go under our blessings, you know, the lack of tzniyus, there's a whole push there to be less religious, it's spiritually dangerous, but they, unlike the hardcore soccer and so on, never come out and say, I mean, Elijah Jordan would never have said, it's usher for a Jewish young man to go to the army. They just try to find all kinds of ways to minimize the possibility of their people, you know, going into the army.
And yet we do see, isn't it fair to say, increasingly there are some, even Hasidim, who seem to be going into the army.
Right.
It's a little bit tangential, but I thought I saw that Gare is sending some.
Oh, Gare, sure, Gare. It's exactly the fact. Gare is the main faction in Aguda. That's the pro within that, you know. They absolutely do. Even before Nachal Haredi, I think they sent in the 70s. And sometimes on those same people come, if they have a weekend off, and they happen to be seen in the streets of whatever neighbor, Beersheba and Gula, in uniform, they have been physically attacked.
Yeah,
so they come into a shul.
Right. And one last thing, Rabbi Meir Shapiro, the Abbezin of Lublin, the famous Rabbi Meir Shapiro. You said earlier that you were not aware of the story. Is it surprising to you, based upon what you've read about Rabbi Shapiro and your knowledge, that he would take this kind of approach? He's practically a Mizrachist in a way. He's going around Hungarians, speaking to them about settling and building the land, for it's well known that they oppose, that these Gedolim oppose the matter. And there's Rabbi Meir Shapiro, the Daf Yomi innovator, the man whose face is all over a good of publications, and he's seemingly a Mizrachist. Am I wrong? Am I assessing this wrong? Any thoughts on that?
What's the word? You use a very good word in reference to Rabbi Shapiro, an innovator. He was a man in some ways that was just this, which had to do with Zionism, but he once had in his yeshiva, you know, he was nifter a very short time, just a very few years after the yeshiva opened. But during that window,
yes,
he brought in a large group of potential major donors, both from Lippe as well as from Germany, for a whole big tour. And you know, the yeshiva and probably the Mekomos, you know, the Jewish places in Lublin and so on. And for the Shabbos, he gave them the royal treatment. You'd relate to this, he hired a professional chazan and choir to engage in the yeshiva. Right, so
something that appeals to me. Anyway.
Right. On the other hand, another year in Ram Naroim, I think unlike the Litvisher Yeshiva Minyan, or later they won anyway, I think the boys were allowed to go home in Ram Naroim. And the totally different groups, I forget which group, I think it was the Vadak. The Vadak wanted to establish their own type of minion for Yom Noroyan, and that's very far from his, you know, his orientation.
Right.
He welcomed them, let them have their minyan there, and he davened there too, and was very mispalled with their brand of refuse. So I'm trying to say he was an innovator. He was open to a variety of things.
A chassidish.
He was absolutely chassidish. I don't know who he followed. But remember, in his part of Europe, for the most part, in the last several years before the war, all the Yiddish tribe was chassidish, unless you had an import. Somebody who from Litza, you know, you had that. Moshe Soloveitchik, you know, the Rav Spad, you know. But they were Litvaks, literal Litvaks. Geographic Litvaks who happened to move to central Poland recently because of whatever their reasons were. But in terms of the indigenous Yiddish tribe, there was very little left there. But they were like Hasidic like before. Bacholer Lava Shalom told me he never heard there was anything but Mishlachsvard in Hasidus. He grew up in a smaller town. But, you know, they didn't see themselves so much as Hasidim. Some did. They were active, you know, connection with the Rebbe. But as far as Yiddish tribe, where among the greatest tzaddikim ever lived with the Baal Shem Tov, the Maggid, and then everybody that goes with it, and then Alvin and Hagen, and so on. So I honestly don't know if he followed the particular Rebbe or was just generically Hasidish. Mm-hmm. But you look at the pictures of the students in the Sefer Shulchan of Lublin, who were drawn in general from the area, more, you know, general area. They didn't look like the literature students at the same time. With a, you know, up-to-date colored suits and light-colored hats and so on. They looked like they just fixed, you know, some more and less, you know, Hungarish or Hasidish. You know who, I just lost my train of thought, but that's what they looked like. And,
thank you. That is fascinating. If you're credit for that, and I want to just pile on, if I may. I stopped in the Aguda of Baltimore on the way to and from New York, and I picked up some CDs at the Aguda by Rabbi Pesach Kron. In one of the CDs, they're all Elul and Rosh Hashanah oriented. In one of them, he talks about Rabbi Meir Shapira, because he was talking about his travels throughout Europe and how he was gleaning lessons for Elul from his various travels, the towns that he visited. And he may have gone to Krakow, and he went to Lublin, and from every little town, he had a little vignette, a little recollection, and a little musavor. It's a great CD. The point is that he's talking about Lublin right now in the CD, and he mentions that Rabbi Meir Shapira created the Yeshiva Chochmas Lublin. He built it as this magnificent, massive edifice, just absolutely beautiful. So I'm told. I've seen pictures. And it is very impressive. And certainly a million times more impressive than the typical, you know, small buildings that were known for yeshivas in other places. So here's this magnificent place, which apparently has been taken over by the government in Poland, and they put a ministry of something in there. I mean, or a medical school. I mean, it's a pretty place. It's a nice building. So what's going on with that? Why is such a big Gewaldige, you know, building? So Rabbi Shapira, if I remember correctly, wanted to promote the Kavod HaTorah, and guess what he did? According to Rabbi Krohn's account, the creator of the Yeshiva Chochmas Lublin, Rabbi Shapira, invited 100,000 people to the laying of the cornerstone was done 4 years before, and then when it opened up, there were 100,000 people invited. It's a massive number. Absolutely incredibly big crowd. And according to the story, somebody may have said to Rabbi Shapira, isn't a little bit over the top? I mean, really, 100,000 people? I mean, for real? Why do that? Why are you inviting that old, you know, Ayin Hara that we all want to avoid if we can? So he apparently said, if I'm not mistaken, it's important for Kavod HaTorah to have people see that we're opening up the yeshiva, and Torah has to have this kind of shtickle fanfare and things like that, a little pomp, nothing wrong with that. He was nifter not long thereafter. Apparently, as Rav Rolov said, maybe 4 years after the opening of the yeshiva, he passed at a very, very young age. And according to the raid on the street, Rabbi Krohn says that he may have had some sort of inkling that his approach wasn't the only one, and may not have necessarily been the most perfect and 100% correct one, with this incredible crowd and Ayin Hara, you know, attraction. Ayin Hara is going to look at this and say, oh, this I got to destroy. And yet, still in all, according to this theory, Rabbi Shapira said, listen, I got some vision. I know what's going to happen. This won't last forever. But right here, right now, there's got to be Kavod HaTorah. And so he went forward with it, knowing that it may not be perfect. It may be a little bit over the top, maybe too much pomp, but I got to do what I got to do right here, right now. And if I remember, that was the story that he said over in the CD, and I wanted to just share that with you for thought and comment. And we can always continue on, but Rabbi Meir Shapira's name comes up, and Rabbi Berlov is commenting at length. So I thought I would just throw in that little story that I heard, and then now we can continue.
Now, I want to say, just imagine the amount of luxury. Now, remember, this is pre-World War II Poland. Their sukkah, I read, had electric heaters.
Wow! That's Grossinger's hotel.
That's what I mean. At the time, it was, you know, so, it spared nothing, you know. But he worked the students in a hot way. I think, in a literacy yeshiva, you made your own schedule to a great extent. It could be a master 20 hours a day if you wanted to be, but it wasn't, his norm wasn't expected. In his yeshiva, looked at the Seder Hayom. They started learning at Seder like 2 hours before Shabbos at 5 or something like that, and went to 10:30, 11. I mean, it was a very, very grueling schedule, and where it was clear what's for Kiyos, what's Ian. He went around, I'm told, before he opened it up to literacy yeshivas of different sorts, and to see, he wanted to get a shrub of every type of approach. I'm saying he was very innovative, so it doesn't surprise me that he would have a positive response over this too, even though sometimes things are not spread, you know, if they don't serve the purpose of the ones who want to spread. You know.
Right. So we got to read wisely and try to find out all we can, but otherwise you'd never... I like to fancy myself a reader as much as I can of different things, but in no good of publications would you ever see this. So I'm delighted to see this in a written form. It's the most amazing thing. Pages 318 and 319 of that Rabbi Meir Shapira. Shkoyach. And now we're going to continue in the middle of page 319. We'll continue with more and more exciting stuff. Page 319, Perek Lamed Ches, and in the marginal notation it says, after experiencing our stepmother's wrath, we can better appreciate our mother. Who's our mother? Israel. Let's go right to it. He writes, our brilliant and holy master, Ritzvi Elimelech, probably of Lezhensk. He says, oh, the Baal B'nai Yisoscha writes as follows, in Igra de Parka, he writes, as follows, I heard in the name of a certain tzaddik that one attains a greater level of, quote, dwelling in Eretz Yisrael, end quote, when he leaves the Holy Land for a period of time and then he returns. He tastes the sanctity more the second time he comes. In my opinion, we learn this from Avram Avinu, because Avram's main stature and eminence came the second time. As it says, quote, Abraham ascended from Egypt. Obviously, as you know, from the scripture, we know that Hashem commands Abraham to go into Eretz Canaan. He enters Eretz Canaan. He sees a famine. He says, oh, this place it's a hungry place. I'm not going to complain. I'm going to do my business. I got to survive. And he leaves pretty immediately to Egypt. However, the Ramban sees that as not a good thing. It's a sin for his level. We're not going there. What we are going to do is we're going to stay with Avram in Egypt. Sarah gets abducted. Avram says, listen, I was afraid of this place. It's a crazy place. I was afraid for her life, my life, everybody's life. So Parah says, listen, I mean, don't embarrass me like that. Here, take a fortune and get out of here. So he takes the fortune and he goes. So suddenly Avram has been enriched tremendously, and this is part of God's plan to give him the name, the eminence, the money, ultimately the children. This is all going to be part of God's plan that he promised Avram. He's walking out of Egypt, ascending up to Israel with lots of money. He and Sarah and Lot and all his entourage. So he says, the Baal, the Ritzvi Elimelech says, Now his main stature and eminence is coming into clarity. It's only the second time. Now that he's entering the Holy Land the second time, now he's Avraham Avinu. Now he's got money, people know who he is now, and so on. He gathers people to him. I will add, Rabbi Tachtel writes, I will add to the words of our mentor, Sefer Charedim cites a Midrash, which states that God originally told Avraham to go to Eretz Yisrael, to see it, and to return to his birthplace. After he returned to his birthplace in Padan Aram, in Ur Kasdim, in Mesopotamia, modern-day Iraq, then Hashem did not allow Avraham to go back to Israel for 5 years. During that time, that five-year period, Avraham longed to return to the Holy Land. And Avraham said, a pasuk in Tehillim. The pasuk in Tehillim is Psalm 55, verses 7 and 8 in English. Oh, that I had wings like a dove. I would fly away and be at rest. Behold, I would wander far off. I would dwell in the desert. The end of those two psukim in Tehillim. Chazal comments on this in Bereishis Rabbah 39, paragraph 8. Quote, it is preferable to dwell in the deserts of Israel than the palaces of Chutz La'aretz. End quote on that Chazal. Before Avraham entered the land, however, he did not long for it. He only truly longed for it after he was there once and saw with prophetic vision, top of 320, he saw with prophetic vision the splendid glory of the sanctity of the Holy Land. We, his descendants, must learn from him and yearn for the land as he did. See Sefer Charedim, published in Jerusalem 1958 on page 196. This is an explicit proof that one feels more sanctity the second time he enters the land, as the above-mentioned tzaddik asserts. I'll take thoughts and comments now.
I have a facetious one. From most, in my opinion, non-Breslov or rational point of view, if the person has the opportunity to spend Yom Teruah in the Eretz Yisrael, Kama Chomer, because he's there already, it would seem to be very, under very few circumstances, justifiable for him to leave for Yom Tov. But now, I can see a justification, because when he gets back, and that's the next time, he may appreciate the difference.
And he's more more inspired, but when he steps away, he misses the Holy Land, and he wants to come back to his mother's embrace. And that is where we're going to go right now, and we're going to finish up. We're a little bit over, but I'm enjoying it so much. We have another page or so, and I have a little bit of time. We're on page 320. We'll end on page 321. But here's the idea about stepmother and mother, which he already mentioned earlier. So let's get right to it. Rabbi Tachtel writes, according to this idea about Avraham Avinu, we can explain the Rambam's ruling about the sanctity of Eretz Yisrael in relation to Shvius, the laws of the sabbatical year, and Maestros, tithing. The laws of tithing. Rambam states that the destruction of the first base of Mikdash dissolved the sanctity of the land and exempted us biblically from keeping the laws of Maestros and Shvius. On the other hand, the sanctity generated by Ezra never dissolved, and the land is still holy today, even though it is not in our possession. Therefore, we are biblically obligated to keep the laws of Shvius and Maestros. Based on the preceding idea, this Rambam is clear. At the time of the second Aliyah, the sanctity of the land became more deeply rooted than it did at first, and it never dissolved, even though the sanctity was less complete than it was during the first Beis HaMikdash era. And it's well known that five things were missing from the second Beis HaMikdash. That was only because all the Jews didn't return, as is well known. However, the sanctity that existed in the land became more deeply rooted than it did at first. I'd like to give a simple explanation as to why the land of Israel tastes better the second time around. Let's imagine a child who is always by his mother's side. She raises him and takes care of him, and he never leaves her, even for a moment. This child cannot appreciate all that his mother has done for him. However, if he is taken from her for some reason and given over to a stepmother for a period of time, then when he returns to his mother's bosom, he understands and appreciates what it means to be by his mother's side. While he stays with his stepmother, he gets a taste of what a stepmother is. He sees and feels how she acts toward him, how she supports him half-heartedly, and how everything she does is forced, unwilling, insincere. Especially if she beats him with abounding hatred. Then when he returns to his true mother, he'll say wholeheartedly what King David said, quote, Pasuk in Tehillim, Psalm 131, verse 2, quote, Surely I have stilled and quieted my soul, like a just weaned child by his mother's side, like a just weaned child is my soul. Yerushalmi comments, by the way, a footnote, Yerushalmi on that pasuk, Sanhedrin, like a baby which has left its mother's womb, so has my soul been to me. See Yerushalmi chapter 2, halacha 4, corresponding to 9a. That is to say, in the land of Israel, one feels like a baby which has left its mother's womb, because the land of Israel is his mother. Back into the text. Such a person who's been through his stepmother and back to his mother, he'll feel that his soul is bound up with his mother's soul, and he will enjoy his mother's meager portions of bread more than his stepmother's quarrelsome feasts. Therefore, since I explained above that Chutz La'aretz is considered the stepmother and Eretz Yisrael the true mother, we can easily understand why a person who returns to Israel a second time has a, quote, better taste for the land than someone who never left it. The same is true today, he says, and with this we finish up. We have experienced the true nature of our stepmother, the lands of exile, in the fullest measure. She has placed her cup of poison before us in all the countries of Europe, and we have drunk and drained its sediments, based on Yeshaya, Yechezkel, and Tehillim. Therefore, every Jew will undoubtedly wake up from his slumber and intensify his aspiration and yearning for his true and proper mother, our holy land. He will refuse to stay in the diaspora any longer. Even in exchange for all of the treasures in the world, he will strive with all his might, with all his heart and soul, and with all his wealth to return to his mother's bosom as soon as possible. He will say what Abraham said when Abraham longed to return to Israel. It is preferable to dwell in the deserts of Israel than the palaces of Chutz La'aretz. So that gracious Rabbah, Chazal say, are Abraham's words. The Medrash states the same idea on the Pasuk in Mishlei, Proverbs chapter 17, verse 1. Better is a dry piece of bread with tranquility in it than a house full of quarrelsome feasts. And here's the Medrash on that Pasuk in Yalkut Shimoni, chapter 2, paragraph 956. Better is a dry piece of bread with tranquility in it. Rabbi Yochanan said, this refers to the land of Israel, for even if a person eats dry bread and salt every day while dwelling in Israel, he is assured a portion in the world to come. Better dry bread than a house full of quarrelsome feasts. What does that mean? This refers to Chutz La'aretz, which is full of violence and robbery. Ladies and gentlemen, some things to think about. Today and this week, the beauty and the importance of the land of Israel. It is our mother, our mother's bosom. We love it. I've got to say, I went to visit Israel for the first time in college, my junior year. My sister was living there at the time. I enjoyed the 2-week stay, enjoyed it very, very much. decided to enroll in yeshiva there. I had friends who had gone to Chappelle's who were NYU students, and went back upon graduation and spent 2.5 years over there. And so maybe I'm also one of those guys who's been bitten by that bug. You go there the first time, not sure what to expect, enjoy it very, very much, overwhelmed by the sanctity of the land and the beauty of it, and you see the city of Jerusalem, it's unparalleled. And then you go back to Chutzlars and you say, you know something, I think I want to go back there a little bit. And you go back there and you spend some time. And maybe I was following in Avraham Avinu's footsteps, doing that too. At all events, I want to thank Rabbi Brillo for coming out and joining us today and elucidating so much. I want to thank all my listeners, those of you who called in today. Sorry about last week, we're back in schedule. God willing, again next week, as we really slowly, but fast in a way, very quickly approach Rosh Hashanah, to take every opportunity to copyright every learning we can. I thank you all. Rabbi Brillo, thank you. Shout out to everybody, wishing everybody a successful and productive week. All the best, Shmuel Plotzker, signing out from Gulf Meadows Synagogue and our School of Jewish Studies. We'll see everybody next Monday at 1 o'clock. Take care and be well. Bye-bye.